I want to quit school, Arthur said. He and his father were examining the boarding on the north side of the barn. Some of the planks were starting to rot and would have to be replaced, and it needed to be done soon. Winter was coming, and a drafty barn could result in a whole herd of cattle coming down with pneumonia. His father straightened up and looked at him. It's a waste of time, Arthur said. I want to quit. His father dug around in his ear with a dirty finger.
Better speak to your mother, he said at last.
I already did.
Yeah?
Yeah. It had taken him weeks to work up the courage to approach her, and even more weeks to work out which words were the right ones, the ones that would convince her. How could he explain to her the pointlessness of carrying on, the futile years he had spent sitting at a desk, the endless exams and his failure to pass them, and the fact that he didn't care? In the end, all the reasons and all the words he could think of added up to just one sentence. It ain't teaching me nothing I need to know, he told her. He'd stood awkwardly in the kitchen, 6'2" in his socks, 240 pounds, a man, not a boy, aching to do a man's work. If one of the plow horses had dropped in its tracks, Arthur could have slung the great leather collar around his own neck and finished the job himself, no trouble at all. At school, he could hardly squeeze his body into the space between the desk and the seat. He wanted to say, "Look at me, Mum, look at me. I shouldn't be sitting at those desks anymore." But he knew that argument would cut no ice. His mother was chopping onions, wiping the tears away with the back of her wrist. Her mouth was a straight white line. She said, "Arthur, you don't know what you're going to need to know in the future." Maybe she was right about that, but he was pretty sure he knew what he was not going to need to know, namely Latin, chemistry, physics, math, French, history, geography, and Charles Dickens. It was true that there was a machine shop at school that had some handy tools in it, but even there he hadn't learned anything his father hadn't taught him already. "If they could teach you how to predict the weather," he said, "that would be good. But they don't teach stuff like that, useful stuff. They don't teach useful stuff." She looked at him uncertainly. "Don't they?" She'd only been as far as grade 8 herself. "No." She hesitated for a moment, and he held his breath. But then her mouth went tight again. "They taught you to read and write," she said. "You didn't think that was useful at the time, but everyone needs to know how to read and write."
"Yeah, but I can," Arthur said. "I know all that stuff. And adding, and subtracting, and multiplying, and that other one, dividing. I don't need more than that, Mum. All the rest I need to know, Dad can teach me, and he needs me on the farm. He needs help. He's got too much work to do on his own."
He felt exhausted. He'd never strung so many sentences together in his life. Surely she must see that he was right. But she pressed her lips together and shook her head. "Your father's managed just fine all these years. He can manage a few more." She sighed, and turned to face him directly, holding the onion knife out to the side, and he knew that he had lost.
"A man without an education is at a disadvantage, Arthur. Your father is at a disadvantage. He's a good farmer, but he's at a disadvantage with educated people." She smiled at him. "You'll thank me one day, I promise you. When you have your grade 12, you'll thank me."
His father, still waggling his finger in his ear, looked at him helplessly.
"What did she say?" he asked. "She said I'd thank her one day."
Arthur's voice was so dragged down by misery it was hardly audible even to him.
"Oh," his father said. "Yeah, well."
He took the nail he'd been using to test for rot and pressed the point of it into another plank of wood. It sank in, ominously.
"Gotta get at this quick," he said.
His voice was sad, apologetic. He'd have liked to help, but he couldn't. November. Arthur and Jake trudged to school each day in the dark, and trudged home again in the dark, and one thing to be grateful for was, at least, now that Jake was older, they didn't have to go together. Most days Jake went in early to meet with his friends, and Arthur went at the last possible moment, sliding in the door just as the bell rang. He and Jake were in separate classrooms, something else to be grateful for. They didn't see each other during the day, except at lunchtime. He sat at his too small desk in an ill-lit classroom and looked out the window at the gray, snow-heavy sky, and endured. All his friends had left school now, to take jobs at the sawmill, or in the silver mines, or on their father's farms. He got to see them only on Saturday nights. He and Carl Luntz, his best friend, would walk into town together with Carl's older brothers, and meet up with Ted Hatchett and Jude Libovitz and the rest, and they'd go and hang about down by Ben's bar. They weren't old enough to go inside, but the liquor generally found its way out, and every Saturday night without fail there would be a fight about something or other, and someone would go home with a broken nose or a couple of black eyes. Arthur mostly didn't take part in the fighting. He could never get that worked up about things, and the only person he'd ever wanted to hit was Jake. But he was happy enough just standing on the sidelines watching. Carl and his brothers were on the peaceful side, too, but Ted Hatchett and Jude Libovitz were both enthusiastic fighters, especially Ted. Ted loved fighting. Any excuse would do. He also loved liquor, so one way or another, Arthur and Carl generally ended up carting him home between them, each with one of Ted's arms across his shoulders, back to where he lived with his mother on Crow River Road. Ted worked in the silver mine. His father had been killed in an accident at the sawmill when Ted was small, and his mother wouldn't let him near the place. She insisted that he work in the mine instead, which involved 2 hours' walk morning and night. But Ted didn't seem to mind. He had no brothers or sisters, so he and his mother were on their own, and Arthur got the impression they were pretty close.
"I'm an only child," Ted wailed mournfully one night as Arthur and Carl dragged him along through the darkness. "Half an orphan. And an only child, so sad, so sad."
"Sad for your mum, all right," Carl muttered breathlessly. Ted was even bigger than Arthur, so he was quite a load. If she could only have one, she sure deserved better than you.
"That's unkind."
Ted was exhaling alcohol fumes, powerful enough to melt the snow under their feet.
"Isn't he unkind, Art?"
"Dunno about that," Arthur said, grinning to himself in the darkness. "Could be right."
Ted's mother would greet them grimly at the door on each occasion, survey Ted's bloody nose or half-torn-off ear, and say, "Take him upstairs. I don't know why you bother with him. Just leave him in a ditch next time." Though she would thank them both on their way out. If it was raining or snowing too hard to go into town, Arthur usually went over to the Luntz's farm and sat on Carl's bed and watched him whittle antlers out of driftwood. Carl's parents, Otto and Gertie Luntz, had emigrated from Germany and still spoke with funny accents, but the boys had all been born in Canada. Their farm was bigger than the Dunn's, big enough that it would support all three boys and their families in due course, and the farmhouse was bigger too, so each boy had a good-sized room of his own. Walking into Carl's room was like walking into a forest. He had antlers on his wall that any stag would have been proud to own. He'd pick up bits of driftwood on the beach and whittle them into prongs, and then glue the prongs together at exactly the right angle and sand them down until you couldn't find a join if your life depended on it. His walls were covered with antlers, moose, caribou, white-tailed deer, and every now and then he'd stick a real set up there in the midst of them and ask Arthur or whoever happened to be passing his bedroom door to pick it out, and nobody ever could.
"But why does he do it, Arthur?"
Mr. Luntz would whisper loudly, his brow furrowed in mock perplexity.
"That is what I asks. There is so many deers in this country, there is so many, many antlers, so why he makes more? You are a friend of him, so maybe you know."
Carl, without looking up from his whittling, would say mildly, "A friend of his, Dad, not a friend of him," and Mr. Luntz would wink at Arthur, and Arthur would grin shyly back. He loved Saturday nights.
The rest of the week had nothing going for it whatsoever. The kids he sat beside at school, those who had stayed on after they were 16, were mostly nice enough, but he didn't belong with them. They were the brainy ones, most of them town-bred, like Steve Williams, whose father ran the Hudson's Bay store, or John Adams, whose father was the minister at the Presbyterian Church. All of them were younger than Arthur. They would nod at him when he came in to take a seat. He was a fixture, like one of the desks. The teacher would start talking, and Arthur's brain would shut down automatically. There wasn't a thing he could do about it. He would stare out the window at the road and at the fields behind it, and the dark, silent trees behind the fields, and his brain would just sit there like a lump of cold pudding. Once, in the middle of a history lesson, it was Canadian history, which turned out, incredibly, considering how little of it there was, to be more boring than the history of any other country on earth, a timber wolf slid out of the shadows, head low, body crouched, yellow eyes fixed on the school. No one else noticed it. The teacher's voice droned on. Arthur watched the wolf. The silver gray of its coat against the silver gray of the birches behind it. The stillness, as if time itself had paused for a moment. The pale, watchful eyes. You could see how it belonged where it was, how it was meant to be in that landscape. You could imagine that it and the shadowed trees behind it were waiting for humans to move on or die out so that they could reclaim the land. "Watch out for the trap lines," Arthur thought, though his father wouldn't be pleased to see it so close to the farms. As if it had heard him, the wolf turned and melted back into the woods. The moment the bell rang at the end of the day, Arthur was off, stamping through the snow back to the farm to help his father with whatever needed doing, and lots needed doing, even in winter. Repairs they hadn't had time for during the summer months, maintenance of the buildings, care of the livestock. The cattle were all in the barn now, the pigs in the shed tacked onto the side of the barn, the horses in their stable. All of them needed to be fed and watered and have the muck cleared out and fresh bedding put down. They needed their feet inspected and their ears looked into and the occasional pat on the nose to encourage them through the long, dark winter days. Jake was meant to go straight home, too, to do his share. But it seemed there was always something that kept him at school late. Arthur didn't care, but his father did.
"Where you been?"
"At school." Jake's face shining with innocent enthusiasm. He was 13 now, and sometime during the last year his looks had turned the corner from being sweet to being handsome, all planes and angles and that wheat-colored hair.
"You come straight home after school. You got work to do."
"But I can't, Dad. We're putting on a play, a real play, by Shakespeare. It's called Romeo and Juliet, and I'm Romeo. He's the hero. He commits suicide." Arthur paused in his task of cleaning a sore on a cow's udder and considered the idea of Jake committing suicide. He turned it over in his mind a couple of times, resting his head against the cow's warm belly. Jake, dead and gone. The idea had appeal, all right. "We're putting it on at Christmas, so we have to practice every night. It's really good, and everybody in town is going to be invited, and we're going to make posters and send them to all the stores, and they'll put them in their window so everyone will know."
"You come home straight after school. You got work to do."
"But, Dad..."
"You come home straight after school."
And then, in the evening, when supper was over, and Jake was in his room doing his homework, and Arthur was in his room not doing his, Arthur would hear their mother's voice arguing gently for Romeo.
"It's so nice that he enjoys school, Henry, and that he's doing so well. They must think he's very talented to ask him to be the hero. I think we should let him do it. I think it would be good for him."
There was silence for a minute. Then Arthur's father, sounding like a man who knew he was going to lose the argument, but had to make his point just the same, said,
"They should know better. They should know better than to make farm kids do things after school."
"It's only until Christmas, Henry. I think it would be wrong to stop him. After Christmas, he will be able to do his fair share of the work again. You and Arthur could manage up till then, couldn't you?"
Arthur imagined his father's big, heavy face, imagined him thinking that to say Jake would do his share of the work again implied that he had ever done it. But their mother had had a dose of flu a month ago, from which she still hadn't fully recovered, and Arthur knew that his father was worried about her and wanted to cause her as little anxiety as he could, and never could resist her anyway. Arthur didn't hate his brother, or not very often. Mostly he just didn't understand him. How did they get to be in the same family? What did Jake want? Because Arthur definitely got the feeling Jake wanted something. You could see it sometimes. There was a fretfulness, a frustration, something indefinable behind the eyes. Christmas came and went. Romeo died for love and was a triumph, according to his mother. Arthur had to take her word for it. He and his father missed the performance. They were supposed to go, but they were in town buying supplies at the hardware store and lost track of the time. Worse still, they had the truck, so Jake and his mother had to hurry the 2 miles to the school through the snow, with Jake's fancy costume wrapped up in a paper bag. They arrived, with only 5 minutes to spare, and found Mrs. Castle, the English teacher-turned-director, almost wringing her hands. When they got home, driven by Otto Luntz — it turned out the whole Luntz family had been there, as had practically every other soul in Struan — Jake went straight to his room without speaking. "He so badly wanted you to come," Arthur's mother said to them, tight-lipped with disapproval. "It was so important to him, and he wanted you to see it. You, most of all, Henry. You, more than anybody."
"Since when is a damn fool play so important?" Arthur's father said sharply, stung by guilt and his wife's reproach.
Arthur couldn't remember her ever reproaching his father before.
"Farming's important. Work's important. Time he knew what matters and what doesn't."
January and February passed, and were easier to get through than usual because the weather was so bad that the school was closed more often than it was open. At the beginning of March there was a blizzard that blew for 10 straight days, and doing the most basic farm chores was so difficult and so unendurably cold that Arthur almost, though not quite, thought that being at school might be a nice rest. Snow piled up against the north side of the house and barns until it reached the roofs, which at least gave them some protection against the howling and demented wind. It buried the pig shed altogether, not once but again and again. Every morning they had to dig down to find it, as if the pigs were victims of an avalanche. It felt like an avalanche, felt as if the entire North Pole was sliding down to bury them. They were prisoners in their own home, and their jailers were the wind and the snow. A couple of times a day they shoveled out a trench from the house to the barn and stable, and another trench to the woodpile, and that was as far as anyone dared to go. Arthur's mother was anxious about Gertie Luntz, who had had her appendix out on her own kitchen table at the end of February, but it was too dangerous to snowshoe over to check that she was all right. The blizzard would swallow you up within seconds. You could be walking in circles for hours and never know it. They spent the days huddled around the kitchen stove, mending everything in sight. All except Jake, who spent most of his time in his bedroom doing whatever it was that Jake did. It was freezing up there. Arthur put off going to bed as long as possible, but still, that was where Jake chose to be. The company of his family bored him. That was plain as day. Even his mother seemed to bore him. And it was true that their conversation wasn't all that stimulating.
"Better get up on that roof,"
this from their father after a groan from the roof timbers.
"Take a shovel. Too much weight on it."
"Okay," from Arthur. That would be it for an hour.
"Would anyone like some tea?"
their mother, cheerfully.
"Sure."
Another hour. Just once, Jake seemed to liven up a bit. It was right after supper. A whole evening of doing nothing lay ahead, and Jake suddenly said,
"We should play cards. I'll go get my pack of cards, okay?"
"I got better things to do with my time than play cards," their father said.
"You do?" Jake said, looking around the room.
They'd run out of things to mend days ago.
"Biggest damn time-waster ever invented," his father said sharply,
suspecting impudence. Jake got up and went to his room. Near the end of that week, one of the horses took sick. They had four Shire horses, huge animals, intelligent and willing, whose forebears had been shipped over from the old country by a farmer in New Liscard 20 years previously and bred by him ever since. This one was a 2-year-old gelding called Moses. They'd had him nearly a year, and he was working out well. But on this dark, snow-driven sub-zero morning, when Arthur and his father battled their way out to the barns, they found him restlessly knocking about in his stall. He was off his feet, couldn't seem to stand still. There was a vet in New Liscard, but he might as well have been on the moon.
The nearest phone was in Struan, and even if they got through to him, all the roads were blocked. By the afternoon, the blizzard still screaming around the sides of the barn, the horse was worse. By evening, he was frantic with pain, throwing himself at the sides of the stall, eyes rolling, froth flying from his mouth.
"Colic," Arthur's father said. Arthur wanted to ask, is he going to die, but couldn't bring himself to say the words. There was nothing they could do to make things easier for him. He was so crazy with pain, they couldn't even get into the stall to try to quiet him with their hands. 1 ton of horse, like a freight train out of control. They stood by his stall, stamping their frozen feet, wretchedly keeping him company, until, finally, about 8 o'clock, they couldn't stand it any more, and Arthur's father went back to the house and got the rifle and shot him. Jake was in the kitchen when they finally went in, curled up in a chair by the stove, reading a book. He looked up and raised his eyebrows at the sight of the rifle.
"You guys hunting in this weather?" he said.
Their father paused, stood in the middle of the room, head down, studying the floor. Then he went and hung the rifle on its rack over the door and left the room.
"What did I say wrong now?" Jake asked.
Suddenly he was furious, close to tears with rage.
"What did I say wrong now?"
Arthur, his mind filled with the image of that great still body on the frozen floor, could think of nothing to say. April. The wind turned around and blew from the south, and like magic, the snow sagged, collapsed on itself, and melted away. The air smelled of damp earth and things trying to grow, trying to force their way up out of the still frozen ground.
"Those two there,"
Arthur's father said, nodding at two heifers over by the fence,
"told Otto I'd send them over this morning. Simplest thing is, you two take them over. Just walk them around."
Arthur nodded. It was Saturday, the best day of the week. Sunday would have been just as good if it weren't for the fact that it was followed by Monday. Jake said, "When?"
"Now," their father said.
"Can't Art take them?"
Jake said.
"I have to go into town."
Their father was in the middle of harnessing the team. He turned slowly and looked at Jake. Arthur felt a prickle of apprehension and also of annoyance. Sometimes he got the feeling that Jake was trying to provoke their father. Yesterday he had forgotten to feed the pigs. How could you forget to feed the pigs? Something that had to be done every day, something that was always done. It was as if he wanted to see just how far he could push their father before he snapped. Arthur couldn't understand it. It was like deciding to stir up a nest of rattlesnakes or prod a hive of bees. Maybe you didn't know the exact details of what would follow, but you did know that it wasn't going to be nice. So why do it? Why didn't Jake just shut up and do what he was told? Their father looked at Jake in silence. Jake shrugged and turned away. Arthur relaxed. He went over to the cows and took their tethers and handed one to Jake. The two of them set off down the track between the fields, leading a cow apiece. There was still snow lying in the furrows, streaking the fields black and white like giant lengths of corduroy. The road was muddy and slippery with patches of ice hidden under the slush, and the heifers were slow.
"I don't know why it takes two of us,"
Jake said, when they were out of sight and earshot of the farm. "Can't you manage 2 cows by yourself?"
"No," said Arthur.
"Why not? You're so good with cows."
"'Cause of the bridge."
"What about it?"
"They don't like it. Scares them. Moves too much. We'll have to take them across one at a time."
"Okay, but once we get them across the bridge, will you take them on? Because I got to get into town. I'm meeting someone."
Arthur shrugged. "Okay."
"Great," Jake said. "Don't tell Dad, all right?"
Arthur shrugged again. They slogged on. Jake, trying to speed things up, eager to be gone, pulling the reluctant heifer behind him. She swung her head unhappily.
"Come on, come on, come on," Jake said.
"Slow down," Arthur said. He felt as if it was him Jake was yanking at.
"She can go faster than this when she wants to," Jake said.
"She doesn't want to."
"Maybe you've got all the time in the world," Jake said, "but I've got things to do."
"The bridge is just up there." Farther into town there was a proper bridge across the river that separated the Dunn's and the Luntz's farms, but this one was a short cut and saved more than a mile. It was roughly made with poles and ropes and wooden planks, sturdy enough, but the poles were long and had a fair bit of spring in them. 15 feet below, Crow River boiled its way over the rocks. It was a pale, icy green, swollen with runoff. Arthur's father and Otto Luntz between them kept the bridge in good order, but the cows didn't know that, and Arthur didn't blame them for their unease.
"Jeez, it's really raging," Jake said, peering down into the foaming water.
Arthur tied his heifer to the handrail of the bridge. "We'll take yours first," he said. It needed 2 people, all right. Arthur pushed from one end and Jake pulled from the other, Arthur saying, "Okay, girl, okay, it's okay." Jake saying, "Come on, you stupid cow." They got her over in the end and tied her to the rail, then started back across the bridge. Jake stopped in the middle and bounced experimentally. The bridge replied in slow motion, heaving under their feet. Arthur grabbed the handrail.
"What are you doing?" he said.
Mostly he just ignored Jake's behavior. It wasn't worth getting worked up about, but today Jake really did seem to be hell-bent on getting whacked.
"I forgot this was so good," Jake said,
letting the motion subside, and then leaning over the rail.
"It really dances."
He leaned over further, trying to see the underside of the bridge. Arthur reached the other end and stepped onto firm ground.
"See that pole?" Jake said. "The one underneath? Bet you couldn't go hand over hand, you know, hanging from it all the way across."
Arthur didn't bother replying.
"Bet you couldn't," Jake said, grinning at him.
"Let's get the cow across," Arthur said. "You got things to do," you said.
"Bet I could go across if you're scared to," Jake said. "Bet you."
"Bet you." His favorite phrase since the day he was born. He turned everything into a competition. It seemed so pointless since he was better than Arthur at everything anyway, but he just had to keep proving it. "Bet you."
"Yeah," Arthur said, "bet you could. Let's get the cow across. I gotta get back to the farm. Thought you were in a hurry anyway." "Bet it wouldn't take me 2 minutes," Jake said, peering over the side again. "Maybe 5 minutes.
He ran to the end of the bridge and scrambled down until he could grab hold of the pole. The sides of the gorge were steep. Once you left the edge, they fell away into a sheer drop, not all that far, but at the bottom were great slabs of granite with water foaming over them. In places the water was deep, maybe deep enough to provide a cushion, but in other places the rocks broke through the surface, glistening, pink as salmon in the sunlight.
"Should I do it?"
Jake said, grinning up at Arthur. Arthur untied the second cow, wondering if he could get her across by himself. She wasn't happy about it. She put 1 foot on the bridge, then took it off again and looked longingly over her shoulder back at the farm.
"I'm going to do it," Jake said.
The bridge gave a little shudder as he grabbed the pole with both hands and swung himself out.
"It's easy," he shouted from under the bridge. "You're so yellow, yellow-bellied, chicken-livered."
"Come on," Arthur said to the heifer. "It's okay, just wobbles a bit." He pulled gently, and she tried again, one foot, then the other. "Atta girl," he said. She stepped forward, all 4 feet on the bridge now, and Arthur kept moving, walking slowly backward, encouraging her. "See? It's okay, isn't it?" "This is great," Jake said from underneath them. His voice broke up each time he moved his hands. "I'm nearly in the middle already. I told you I could do it. It's great." Arthur and the cow were nearly in the middle, too, but the motion was worse now, and Jake's hand-over-hand movements were adding to it. The cow staggered. The bridge swung sharply in response, and she staggered again. Arthur cursed his brother. "Damn you," he said. "Damn you."
"Art,"
Jake said, his voice suddenly different. "Don't shake the bridge. It's slippery. It's wet here." Arthur ignored him. The cow was really scared now, pulling back against the rope, her eyes rolling. "Come on now," Arthur said, gently as he could. "Nearly there. Come on." She tried another step, managed it, took another. They were right in the middle now. Jake didn't seem to be moving at all. They were ahead of him, the bridge at its maximum swing.
"Art, stop walking! I can't hang on!"
He must think there was no limit to Arthur's gullibility. "Come on, girl," Arthur said. "Come on."
"Art!"
Panic in his voice.
"I mean it. I can't hang on."
Arthur stopped. He hated his brother. At that moment, he truly did hate him. This love he had for getting himself into situations that might or might not be dangerous, and yelling for Arthur to rescue him, and Arthur never knowing whether to believe him or not, and finally having to believe him for their mother's sake, only to find that Jake had been kidding once again. Jake loved that. Loved proving to Arthur and the world just how stupid Arthur was, how gullible. He never got tired of proving it.
"Art!" his voice a shriek. "I'm going to fall!"
"Good," Arthur said, a word that would haunt him for the rest of his life. He felt Jake fall, felt his weight leave the bridge, just like that. For a moment, he was paralyzed, disbelieving. He couldn't even draw a breath. He stood in the middle of the bridge, staring at the cow, his eyes wide. Then his breath came in with a rush, and he grabbed the rail and looked over. For a moment, he couldn't see Jake because he expected him to have been washed downstream, whereas in fact, he was almost directly under the bridge. He was face up, wedged between two rocks. Water was streaming around and over him, over his face. Arthur didn't remember afterward how he got down to the riverbed. He must have slid down the bank or jumped. He waded out into the icy surge of the river, the breath shocked out of him by the cold. He grabbed Jake under the arms and dragged him to the shore. For one ridiculous moment, he wondered if this could be another trick, if Jake could have planned the fall and was playing dead or unconscious for fun, one further, final joke. But Jake's head lolled to the side, and the water streamed out of his nose and mouth in a way that made Arthur cry out with fear. He couldn't get up the bank the way he had come down. It was too steep to climb unencumbered, let alone carrying a body. He waded along the edge of the river, sometimes thigh-deep, the water boiling around him, stumbling over the rocks, feet and legs, numb and unresponsive as tree trunks looking for a way up. He carried Jake in his arms at first, and then, once he found a way up, slung him over his shoulder, panting with fear. He thought Jake was alive, was pretty sure he'd felt him cough, but he couldn't stop there in the middle of the river to be sure, and Hugh knew what injuries he might have or what further damage he, Arthur, might be doing by heaving him up and over his shoulder. But what else could he do? He could not carry him in his arms up the bank, and he could not leave him in the water. At the top, he lowered Jake carefully to the ground to check that he was breathing. And he was. So he picked him up again and ran. All the way across the fields he could see nothing but his mother's face. How could he walk into the house like this, carrying his brother's body? How could he face her?
It was impossible to just walk in on her unannounced. She would die from the shock of it. He prayed that his father would be in the farmyard, or in one of the nearest fields. "Please, God, please," sobbing the words as he staggered along. His prayer was answered. His father saw him coming. Arthur saw him straighten up and stand for a minute, wondering what it was that was heading toward him over the fields, and then start toward them slowly, and then abruptly at a run. "Tell Mom!" Arthur shouted when his father was close enough. He was crying and found it hard to get the words out.
"Tell Mom! Get the doctor!"
In nightmares, in years to come, scenes from that day came back to haunt him. Jake's face underwater, that image most of all. But also Jake laid out on the kitchen table, his legs at an angle no legs could possibly assume, and their mother bending over him, literally wringing her hands, her worst nightmares come true. She kept sobbing, "What happened? Oh, Arthur, what happened?" He should have told her then, told her everything, but he couldn't do it. So he said he slipped. He just slipped. And kept saying it every time she asked, trying to make it true. Just before his father arrived with the doctor, followed by the hearse, which doubled as an ambulance, Jake opened his eyes. Arthur could see him trying to focus on the ceiling. Then, with a huge effort, he turned his head a fraction and his eyes moved slowly around the room, taking in his mother and then settling on Arthur. After a moment, his lips moved, as if he wanted to say something, to damn Arthur without a doubt, to accuse him, to tell the truth. "Tell her," Arthur thought, suddenly wishing he would. "Tell her what happened. He deserved it. He just wanted it over with." But Jake said nothing. Maybe he couldn't get the words out. He closed his eyes again, and shortly after that, Dr. Christofferson arrived and examined him briefly, Arthur's father standing flat against the wall as if pinned there by shock, and then, with the help of Mr. Leroy, the undertaker, carefully shifted Jake onto a stretcher and took him away. Arthur was still standing in the middle of the room, going over and over those final seconds on the bridge, trying to change them, trying to replace what happened with what should have happened, what he should have done. Worse still, going over and over what he had said, that one unbearable, unforgivable word, trying to unsay it. Desperate to find a way around the unalterable fact that once you have said something, it is said. Once it has left your lips, you cannot take it back. Chapter 5. Town lights out. Air rifles banned. 50 years of silver production. Temiskaming Speaker, May 1957. Mrs. Christofferson had been Dr. Christofferson's nurse as well as his wife, so when she left, Ian's father was in a fix. After a week or two of chaos, he seemed to realize that he was going to have to do something about it, even if only, as he had told Ian, for the short term. At that stage, it was clear to Ian that his father still believed his wife was going to come back. In the meantime, the doctor placed an advertisement in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. RN wanted, he wrote, for small northern town. He should have left out northern and maybe small as well. There were only two replies, and one of those dropped out when she realized just how far north Struan was. The other one, Jesse Armitage, came out of ignorance. By then, it was summer, and the lake was at its most benevolent. The sun shone every day. It had been a dry spring, and there were remarkably few mosquitoes. The nurse, 22 years old, Toronto-born and bred, was enchanted. "It's so beautiful up here," she said to the patients, as she changed a dressing or gave an injection or extracted a pea from a child's ear. "I had no idea there was some place so beautiful in my own country." But then came autumn, and the equinoctial gales began to blow, stripping the trees of their leaves as if they were disgraced. The lake turned gray and sullen, and the swells weren't gentle any more. They heaved ominously, and tattered rags of spray blew off their tops. The wind barreled down from the north, driving before it clouds as dark as slate. Pale curtains of rain swept across the lake. Someone in the town said to Jesse Armitage, "This is nothing. You wait till it snow instead of rain out there. Then you'll see something. Then you'll learn what cold is." Jesse Armitage went back to Toronto. Ian found his father down at the lake one evening, watching the waves hurl themselves at the shore. It was working up to a major storm. "I can't understand how anyone can fail to love it," Dr. Christofferson said. His tone was almost apologetic, as if he were making a confession. Then he added, and Ian saw that it was a confession in a way, "Your mother hated it. The North, I mean. I thought in time she would come to feel the same about it as I do, but she didn't." Ian said nothing. His father made a lot of excuses for his mother in those early days, as if he were trying to convince Ian that she was justified in deserting them. The night after she left, he had said with a wretchedness that brought Ian close to despising him, this man whom he had always admired above all others, "You mustn't blame her. It's my fault, really. She was bored here. It wasn't fair to bring her here." Ian had stared at him, sick with disgust. Was that supposed to be an excuse for deserting her family and running off with another man, that she was bored? He thought of Laura, who never stopped working from the moment she got up in the morning, and whose companion in life was the most boring man on the planet. You didn't hear her moaning about it. She would have said, if you had asked her, Ian was convinced of this, she would have said that her place was with her husband and children, and that was all there was to it. In the spring, Dr. Christofferson placed another ad in the medical journal and got no replies at all. "How would you like to be a nurse?" he said to Ian. And Ian said, "Very funny," though he knew his father was only partly joking. What choice did he have, after all? If he really needed help, who else was there to give it? Mrs. Tuttle would faint dead away if she were asked to so much as put on a Band-Aid. A new teacher, Stanley Bannister, came to take the place of the geography teacher Ian's mother had run off with, and brought with him his new wife Margie, who happened to be a nurse, and Ian thought he was safe. But after about 6 months, the Bannisters built a house out on Crow River Road, too far away for Margie to be of any help if there was an emergency outside of office hours, and a surprising number of people managed to have their emergencies outside of office hours. Ian resented being called on. He knew his father had no option, but he still resented it. It wasn't the work itself he minded. Blood and gore didn't bother him, and it turned out that he was good at calming kids, maybe even better than his father. So it wasn't that he particularly disliked the things he was asked to do. What he minded was the fact that he had to do them, the reason behind it. "Getting a little bit of practice, are you?" the patients would say, or, "You'll have a head start when you get to medical school." Ian, helping to hold a struggling child or preparing the mask for chloroform, would nod and say nothing, because it wasn't worth denying it. But as time passed, the patients got used to him filling in for Margie out of hours and no longer commented on it, and Ian got used to it too. He still felt resentful whenever he thought about it, but he didn't think about it much anymore. The day before his 17th birthday was a Saturday, and Laura baked Ian a cake. It had pride of place on the kitchen table when he and Arthur came in from the fields at lunchtime. "It's not really a birthday cake," Laura said, "because it's bad luck to celebrate your birthday early. That's why there aren't any candles. It's just a cake." It was huge and round, and covered with gooey chocolate icing, a kid's cake, but it did look good. They had some for dessert, and then, later in the afternoon, when Ian and Arthur took their tea break, there was more cake to go with the tea. They sat on old burlap potato sacks that Arthur tossed down on the tall grass at the edge of the field. Robert and Edward were behind them, still harnessed but unhitched from the plough, cropping grass with a sound like tearing bedsheets. It was hot, and the grass smelled sweet and new, and the bees were droning around, as if it were high summer, though it was still only May. The tea came out of a thermos, but was still hot enough to take the roof off your mouth. The cake, two great slabs of it, was carefully wrapped in waxed paper.
"So, what you doing for your birthday?"
Arthur said, his voice breaking in on the quiet made Ian jump. Days spent with Arthur consisted of vast rolling plains of silence, with the odd half-dozen words dropped into them like stones, and the stones always took him by surprise.
"I haven't really thought about it," he said.
Arthur was trying to shake the icing back onto one of the wedges of cake. It had glued itself to the waxed paper. He shook it violently, and it sagged in the middle and then dropped down onto the cake with a nearly audible thud.
"Here you go," Arthur said, passing him a slab.
"Thanks," Ian said. "It's great cake." They were practically having a conversation. When he'd first started working for Arthur, the silence had seemed spooky, whole days with scarcely a word. He didn't mind. In fact, at the time, he was relieved not to have to make conversation. He could absolutely rely on Arthur not to ask how he and his father were making out. In any case, it wasn't really silence. There were plenty of sounds, mostly from the horses, the heavy, regular thud of their feet, the powerful sawing of their breath, the clanking and creaking of their harnesses. And there were birds and cicadas, and the buzzing of insects, and the barking of the dogs, and the odd woodpecker hammering away in the distance. He'd tried having silence at home once or twice. For years he'd automatically switched on his radio when he walked into his bedroom. But after working for Arthur for a while, he tried leaving it off. The quality of the silence at home was different, though. It seemed to make his mother's absence more noticeable. And the sounds that broke it were anything but restful. Babies howling in the waiting room, sometimes yells from his father's office, the phone ringing, Mrs. Tuttle answering it and muttering anxiously as she made her way along the hall to his father's office. She hated answering the phone. What if someone died while she was talking to them? What if someone was having a heart attack and breathed his final words down the phone line? In the evenings, if there were no calls for his father, and genuine silence descended on the house, it had a heavy quality, as if it were laden with the depression which had settled on Ian's father since his mother left. So he switched his radio back on and let Elvis and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly fill the silence for him. Now he sat beside Arthur and listened to the bees and the tearing bedsheets and Arthur slurping his tea out of a chipped enamel mug. There were half a dozen heavy, lumbering footsteps behind them, and Edward's gigantic nose appeared over Arthur's shoulder. He was intrigued by the cake.
"Get off," Arthur said, and smacked him with a backward sweep of his hand.
Edward tossed his head and backed away, then paused, and Ian felt his gaze. He hunched his shoulders and curled himself over his cake.
"Get off,"
Arthur said again, threateningly. Edward gave up and thudded back to Robert and blew petulantly into his ear. Robert shook his head violently. Edward was the younger of the two, and Robert had no patience with him.
"Aren't you having a party? A few friends around?" Arthur said, breaking all records in the conversation stakes.
"I don't think so. I've got an exam on Monday. I'm going to have to study tomorrow." Arthur nodded sympathetically and slurped his tea, and Ian was swept by a wave of shame. Because Arthur, whatever his limitations, was a really nice guy, and he still didn't have a clue that Ian was only there because he was in love with his wife, and even less of a clue that sometimes, after dark, Ian returned to the farm. Returned, and stood silently within the black shapes of the trees at the edge of the farmyard, like some dark ghost haunting her. "Do you have a girlfriend, Ian?" Laura had asked a few months ago, and he'd been momentarily gripped by panic. Why did she ask? Had she noticed how he watched her? Did she know how he felt about her? Maybe she could see through him. Maybe she had known from the very first time he had come to the farm asking for a job. But she looked merely interested, not mocking or teasing him. And so he mumbled, yes, sort of, he did. He wasn't quite sure how he'd managed it, but he had a girlfriend, all right. He'd acquired her about a year ago, when a whole group of them from his class went out to Lowdown Point the night after their last exam for a little end-of-year celebration. They'd made a fire on the beach and roasted hot dogs and marshmallows, and a couple of the guys had smuggled in some hooch, and they all got drunk. They went swimming in the dark. Some of them had had the foresight to wear their bathing suits under their clothes, and the others, Ian included, swam in their underwear. A few boys, the ones who spent their entire lives showing off, and a couple of girls, the ones you'd expect, went skinny dipping. There was a lot of splashing and screaming and falling about, but remarkably no one drowned or fell into the fire or cracked his head open by diving onto one of the rocks off the end of the point. The water was still very cold, and when they got out their teeth were chattering so hard that no one could speak. They threw more wood on the fire, and everybody huddled around it, close as they could get without singeing their eyebrows, and passed around the hooch, and yelled, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog," at the cold and distant stars. Every now and then, someone threw more wood on the fire, and the sparks whooshed up and vanished into the night. Pete was there to start with, but he kept to the fringes like he tended to do in groups. He wandered off soon after they got out of the water. Ian found himself sitting beside Kathy Barrett, whose dad worked for the hydro company. She was pretty and nice and very cold, and he was quite drunk, so he started rubbing her back vigorously to warm her up. One thing led to another, and in the morning he discovered that they were going steady. In some ways he was pleased. He hadn't had a girlfriend before, and wasn't sure that not having one was entirely his own choice. Ever since his mother left, it had been in the back of his mind that where girls were concerned he might have been tainted by her disgrace. So Kathy's choosing him—it was she who had sat down beside him, not the other way around—was reassuring. Plus he liked the look of her, and the smell of her, and the way she leaned against him and let him slide his arm around her right away. Compared to Laura, she was nothing special, of course. He knew he shouldn't compare them, but he couldn't help it. Kathy was small and rounded, with clear pale skin and dark shiny hair, whereas Laura was tall and slender and golden, and in another league as far as beauty went. And Kathy was just a girl, whereas Laura was a woman. They hadn't got much beyond kissing that first night. Ian would have liked to go further, would have liked to go all the way, come to that. Who wouldn't? But there were two kinds of girls, the nice ones and the easy ones, and Kathy definitely fell into the first category. Even if she'd been easy, though, he probably wouldn't have gone all the way. He wasn't drunk enough for that. Lots of other guys his age did, he knew that, but the idea of sex outside of marriage made him think of his mother. Also, he could never rid his mind of the possible consequences. Sometimes he thought that too close an acquaintance with consequences was ruining his youth, though at other times he thought this was just an excuse, and the truth was that he was chicken. You were supposed to do crazy things when you were young, but he never could. Like going out onto the ice too soon after freeze-up, for instance. Kids did it all the time. But they hadn't seen the bodies of other kids who had gone through the ice, whereas he had. It happened practically every winter, and made his father speechless with rage. The same problem applied to going all the way with girls. He knew with complete certainty that if he did it with a girl just once she'd get pregnant. Even if he managed to get hold of a safe, and how was he supposed to do that in a town where his father and the pharmacist had known each other all their lives?
Even if he managed to get hold of one from a friend, say, it would turn out to have a hole in it. Still, when he was out with Kathy, he always pushed things as far as he could. Over the past few months, he'd managed to persuade her to let him touch her top half, and he kept trying to work his way further south. It was a long, slow process, though. There seemed to be a number of stages he had to go through. Initially, she let him feel her breasts, but wouldn't let him see them, which was strange and frustrating, though better than the other way around. The softness of her breasts astounded him, the way the nipples hardened under his touch. They were incredible, miraculous. He couldn't get enough of them. Though sometimes, right in the middle of fondling her, these sessions took place at the Jessups, who were friends of Kathy's parents and whose 2-year-old Kathy babysat most Thursday evenings, he would find himself wondering what Laura's breasts would feel like. The idea made him breathless, dizzy with lust. Made him try to slide his hand up the warm, silky skin of Kathy's inner thigh and force her down onto the Jessup sofa, his erection throttled by his jeans. Kathy would push him away, hissing, "Ian, stop it, stop it!" Though despite her fierce commands, Ian was pretty sure she liked it when he got so steamed up. She couldn't know that she wasn't the sole cause. It made him feel vaguely ashamed, though not ashamed enough to stop doing it. His mother sent him a present for his birthday, a large package wrapped carefully in brown paper, which arrived several days before the event. He opened it at once to get it over with. "Hope you like it, darling," his mother's note said. "I'll be thinking of you all day." It was a jacket, waterproof, lined with some material light and warm as goose down. He would never wear it. His father gave him a canoe. They already had a canoe that had belonged to Ian's grandfather, but it was broad and beamy and paddled like a pig, whereas this one was long and slender. You could see that it would slide through the water like a knife. It was cedar strip and had been varnished inside and out until it glowed like warm honey. "Where'd you get it?" he asked his father. He'd never seen anything so beautiful. It was tied to the dock, resting on the water so lightly you'd think it weighed no more than a leaf. It was their own dock. Ian's grandfather had bought the plot of land between their house and the lake and had cut a path through the trees so that they'd have access to the water. There was a bell on the dock, a large brass one hanging from a gallows that could be rung to summon the doctor if he happened to be out fishing when his services were required. Ian's grandfather had been a keen fisherman, and so was Ian's father, though nowadays he seldom had the time. They had their own small bay with a crescent of beach sheltered between two long points of rock. On a rough patch of ground behind the beach, they'd built a boathouse where the old canoe and the rowboat lived. The doors to the boathouse were open, and Ian saw that another rack had been fitted for his canoe to rest on. "Tamagami," his father said. "I asked John Raven to keep a lookout for one. He spotted it when he was down there a while back. It's been in the boathouse down by the docks for the past month. Pete brought it over for me last night." "It's beautiful," Ian said. His father looked at him and smiled, and Ian had to look away. His father so badly wanted him to be happy that it made him sad. "I'm fine," Ian wanted to say, which was true most of the time. "You're the one who's not. You should worry about yourself." "Think I'll go for a little test run," he said, crouching down to unlace his shoes. "Want to come?" His father shook his head. "Another time. Don't be late for church." Ian undid the mooring line and stepped delicately, barefoot, down into the canoe. It shivered slightly under his weight, but it took him only a second or two to get the balance of it. The floorboards were warm and mellow under his feet. "Thanks, by the way," he said, looking up at his father. Dr. Christofferson nodded. It was still early morning, not yet 8 o'clock, but already the sun was strong. It beat down on them, his father on the dock, himself in the boat. A little band of ripples sprang up out of nowhere and patted the sides of the canoe. He paddled down the shore,
listening to the slippering of the water under the hull, wondering about his father's motives in giving him such a present. It must have cost a lot of money for a start, and they weren't rich. His father was useless, Ian's mother's word, and he hated to agree, but it was true, at extracting payment from his patients. In due course, he'd say uncomfortably, when you feel able. The whole business of money embarrassed him. But leaving the cost aside, a canoe was a strange gift when you thought about it, for someone who would be leaving home in a little over a year's time, hardly something you could stuff in your suitcase and take with you. He wondered if that could possibly be intentional. No, that was stretching things. Not intentional, but unconsciously, could his father have sought to give him something that he would love but would have to come back to Struan to use? Could he be trying to plant in Ian's mind a seed of longing for the north that would grow in him while he was away and finally draw him home? His father took it for granted, Ian knew this, that he would go to college, would in fact have pushed him if he'd been unwilling to go. But he also knew his father wanted him to come back. He had never said so, but he didn't need to. Ian knew it in his bones. Deep down, his father hoped that he would go into medicine and join him in the practice. If you confronted him with this, he would look astonished and deny it. He would say that it went without saying that Ian must choose what he wanted to do with his life. But it also went without saying that he hoped Ian would choose medicine and Struan. It would have been bad enough to disappoint him, to leave home with no intention of returning for anything but the odd holiday, if everything had been normal. But in the circumstances, leaving his father alone, knowing how low he could get, it scared Ian sometimes, the depth of his father's depression. He'd always thought of his father as invulnerable, thought he had the answer to everything. That was the impression he gave, not just to his patients, but to Ian as well. He looked rock solid, unshakable. But it wasn't so. Mostly, he seemed to be all right while he was working. He kept his regular office hours with Margie Bannister, his nurse, and did his rounds and listened to his patients and their woes just as he always had. And he was generally fine in the mornings. At breakfast, they both sat in the kitchen and read the paper. They were both early risers, so even on school days, breakfast was a fairly leisurely affair. It was in the evenings that he went downhill. He fought against it. Ian could see that. He tried. In fact, the trying was the most painful thing to watch. Supper times, when he was going through a bad patch, were an endurance test, made worse by the fact that his father seemed to think they should eat properly, sitting at the big, polished table in the dining room, as they had done when Ian's mother was there. Ian disliked the room. It still reeked of his mother's presence. It and the living room were full of her little touches, the lacy runner on the sideboard, the cut-glass vases which had never held flowers because there was nothing but weeds, his mother maintained, within 400 miles of Struan. The low table lamps on each of the side tables. Don't they look charming? He remembered her saying when the lamps first arrived. You see the way they cast little pools of light. It's so simple, so elegant, don't you think? She had moved one of the lamps fractionally to the right. It was one of the few times he remembered her looking happy, which made the memory all the more painful. She didn't buy the lamps in Struan, of course. You could get oil lamps at the hardware store to guard against the possibility, in fact the certainty, of power cuts during winter storms, but they were functional. Struan hadn't caught up with the idea of a charming home yet. Struan had never heard the word decor. Eaton's catalogue, the other Bible, Ian's father called it, because in many of the homes he visited it was the only other reading material in the house, hadn't heard of it either. But at least they had proper lamps. And, with a little bit of imagination, Ian's mother said wistfully, you could create the sort of look that turned a house into a home. In Ian's opinion, they should have thrown everything out the day she left, cleared the house of the ornaments and knick-knacks, the candlesticks and picture frames. But they hadn't, and all of them were still sitting there, covered with dust. Dusting wasn't Mrs. Tuttle's forte, waiting to ambush your memory. Why couldn't they eat in the kitchen, which had always been Mrs. Tuttle's domain? Why couldn't they sit in there in the evenings as well as the mornings? Though the truth was that he knew why. He knew that his father felt the need to maintain a semblance of normal family life, so he said nothing, and they sat in the dining room night after night. Mrs. Tuttle prepared their supper. On Friday she made things that they could heat up on the weekend, and set the table before she left, and they ate there formally, and made polite conversation, even when there was nothing to say.
"Loaded with fat," his father would announce, his voice strained with the effort of lightness, helping himself to a piece of Mrs. Tuttle's fried chicken. "Grease coagulating in your gut, arteries clogging up, will both be dead within the year."
"Worth it, though," Ian would say, going along with it, playing his part. His father would nod in agreement. "Oh, yes, a fine way to go." Or they discuss their days. "Joyce Ingram's was in again today." "Yeah, I saw her sitting there. She should have a chair with her name on it. What was the matter this time?"
"Nothing at all."
"Can't you just say you're imagining it? Go home." His father shook his head. "She needs the reassurance. Hypochondria is a disease in a way." Like depression, Ian thought. If so, he did feel sorry for her. "Maybe what she needs is to actually get sick," he said. It seemed to help his father if you could get him involved in conversation, as if his brain were less vulnerable when it was concentrating. But it was hard work getting him there, like winding up an old gramophone that was forever running down. Then she'd know the difference. Has she ever had anything really wrong with her?
"Not that I can recall. Had the flu a few years back. A mild dose, no danger."
"She'll be really pleased when she dies," Ian said. "She can have 'I told you so' carved on her tombstone."